This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Well, today on Dreamland, I'm coming to you from not my usual office. I am in San Diego. I had to leave Santa Monica not because of fires this time, but because of particulate matter. So I'm a bit of a nomad. I'm heading down from here to Mexico in a little while. But before I do that, I have got a guest for you that I know you love as much as I do. Andrew Collins is back with us. Andrew is one of the most frequent guests on Dreamland and one of the most popular for a simple reason. He's one of the most interesting people in the world. And he's got a new book out called Karahan Tepe. Is that the correct pronunciation, Andrew? Yes.
There we go. Yes, Karahan Tepe. And it's got a long subtitle of Civilization of the Anunnaki and the Cosmic Origins of the Serpent of Eden. And we'll hopefully get on to all of that as we come along with the questions and answers.
I have a few questions.
Well, good. I'll try
all
and,
right.
And answer as concise as possible.
Andrew really needs no introduction. Andrew, but why don't you give us an idea? I've never asked you this in the many times you've been on the show. When did you start this? When you've gone on an incredible lifelong quest.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for me, as a child, I was always into everything from, trying to see ghosts to trying to spot UFOs to attempting to astrally project, dream interpretation. I remember going down to the library on one occasion and borrowing books by Sigmund Freud on dreams. I was only about 9 or 10 and couldn't understand a word of what they were saying, to be honest. It was just too far advanced. And, so my interest was always there. But I think when you go to high school, you've got other things on your mind, and you also find that most other people just think you're a bit of a crackpot being into this sort of stuff. So you tend to put it to one side. But then as soon as I started work at the age of 16, which was with an export shipping company, actually, that's where I started my world. I started to read pulp paperbacks on UFOs, by the likes of, Jacques Vallée, John Keel, Brinsley Libera, Trench, Raymond Drake, and of course, obviously, Eric von Daniken. And I realized that there was something out there, an intelligence, one that was clearly connected with UFOs, one that seemed to have an interest not only in humanity, but in individuals. So I decided to get closer. And I thought the best way to do that was to become a UFO investigator. So I started investigating cases, and initially it was just lights in the sky or maybe a daylight disc or something like that. But gradually I started investigating people that had close encounters. And what I realized is that there was some kind of psychic connection between the observer and what is observed. And this made me realize that the phenomena was more than simply nuts and bolts spacecraft. There was something else going on here. And at first I couldn't accept it because, I was very much a nuts and bolts guy, I believed that the vehicles were arriving here from another planet and that was it. But the more I looked into it, the more I realized that there was something far more exotic going on. And that followed me through. And I mean, I know we're supposed to be talking about Karahan Tepe, but and we'll come on to that.
No, we'll get to that.
That's my other hat. I mean, I wear various hats, and one of them is obviously, history and science writer, but the other obviously is, UFO researcher, and yet another is what we call psychic questing, but that's for another day. But with the UFOs, eventually I investigated the first ever UFO abduction case in the UK involving a whole family of five who encountered a UFO, then entered this luminous bank of green mist at a place called Averley in Essex, which is the county that I live in, and they lost 3 hours. And hypnosis subsequently revealed some kind of onboarding experience, but there was no landed UFO involved. And it looked like they'd gone into this luminous bank of green mist. And as that happened, there was sort of like a silence, that the car headlights had failed, the car engine had failed, and this was all before Close Encounters of the First, sorry, of the Third Kind, the film, by the way. And what happened was that everything just went silent, everything went dead, they felt nauseous, and then the next thing they know, they're driving along the same road, but 3/4 of a mile further on. And when they get home, they realize that 3 hours are missing from their life. And the weird thing was is that as they all went into this, there was a the male and the female in the front, their 3 children in the back, only one of which was awake. The other 2 children were asleep. And when they came out 3/4 of a mile further on, and as we subsequently find 3 hours later, the children were in exactly the same places. So if physical, biological entities had been involved with this abduction, what happened here? Did they put the people back in exactly the right places, as they came out of the experience, just to try and cover up the fact that it had taken place? Or was there something even more interesting going on here? And what I eventually realized is that when they'd entered into this luminous bank of green mist, they basically exited normal space time. They had both temporal and spatial, distortion, and that they'd gone somewhere, absolutely, because they had, an incredible experience to tell, but it was outside of normal space time. And I talked all about this in a book I wrote called The Circle Makers, which came out in 1992. And this was
Thank
where I
God.
began to
Somebody else who
realize.
has books coming out a long time ago, like me. Go
Oh
ahead.
yeah. Oh well, I mean, well, my first book, I think, came out in 1983, I think. So, a long time ago. But so anyway, that was the start of me looking into UFOs from a different perspective. And eventually I realized that the key was plasma, and that plasma can have a full state of, well, it's a full state of matter, but it can also have an extra dimension of space. So in other words, it acts as a vehicle that will take you out of normal space time into a multi-dimensional environment, and obviously, bring you back again, hopefully. And I developed all these theories, which have been published in various books, such as Alien Energy, that came out in 1994, Light Quest, which came out in 2012, and more recently, Origins of the Gods, that was co-authored with my good friend, Dr. Gregory Little, who you obviously know very well, also.
Yes, we
And
talked about that on this show.
and the incredible thing about all of this, and one of the reasons why I think I'm talking about it now, is that with all of this New Jersey drone phenomena recently, what's come off of the back of that is an incredible popular interest in plasma orbs, plasmoids, which are being videoed, and lots of good videos are going up online, and people are talking about this a lot. And there was a paper that came out last February, by a academic named Ron Joseph, and a whole series of international team that talked about plasma being not just the key to UAP and UFOs, but also that plasma was itself living entities, or what he called pre-life. In other words, that it was intelligent, it was sentient, and
Yes.
it exists up in the upper atmosphere, within the ionosphere, but it also obviously is within the environment. It's generated by the Earth itself, and within that, these buoyant plasma objects can suddenly appear, which can be any shape. They can shape shift, they can be quite solid, they can also be invisible, they can be quite gaseous, they can also appear like these luminous banks of green mist, which we're just talking about here. And if you come too close to them, you quite literally are taken out of normal space time, or there are distortions in space time. And this is something, of course, that many people have known about for decades. I mean, people like Jacques Vallée and John Keel, were very much aware of this type of activity. Obviously, people like Michael Persinger, the Canadian neuro scientist, he realized back in the 70s that there was this relationship between the electromagnetic fields that were being produced by the UFOs that he called space-time transients, and effects upon the human body, inducing altered states. But more than that, it's like creating an alternative reality. Jenny Randles wrote a lot about this in her book Time Storms and other books as well. So that's the area that I come from to do with the UFO side. I'm not discounting the fact that there aren't nuts and bolts, vehicles that have visited this Earth in the past. They probably have, but I think that most of what we refer to as UAP or UFOs can be seen in terms of as plasma objects that can also act as almost like wormholes, bringing forth, linking two places, and perhaps even bringing forth extraterrestrial influences through those wormholes into our own, local reality, basically. So that's one of my hats. But the other hat, of course, and they don't generally try and cross over, is the ancient civilizations, which is something that I've been working on since the early 1990s. My first book in that area was From the Ashes of Angels, which I think we've talked about before. It's that
Yes.
book that came out in 1996. And basically, that was written in the previous year, just as the first spades were going into the ground at Göbekli Tepe. And what I said in this book is that the myths and legends relating to these incredible flesh and blood-like beings that are described as the Watchers, the Nephilim, the Anunnaki, are actually the memory of the prime movers behind the first post Ice Age civilization, which began in the area of southeastern Turkey, probably around 9,000 BC, I think the date I gave at the time.
Yes.
And of course, we now know that that is probably true for the because that area has produced not just Göbekli Tepe, but also Karahan Tepe and a dozen or more similar sites, which are now under investigation, being excavated. That shows us that the first post Ice Age civilization was in this area, and that it was that the memory of it was recorded within Sumerian, Babylonian, Assyrian tradition, as that of the Anunnaki. So although I know that a lot of people want to see the Anunnaki as space beings that came down, and created humanity or genetically manipulated, sort of early hominin to mine gold, which was then taken off the planet and whatever, a la Zachariah Sitchin. But for me, that doesn't really work. For me, all of the Sumerian texts that talk about the Anunnaki suggest that they were flesh and blood beings that gifted humanity civilization. That's what the texts say. And I think that just as Klaus Schmidt did, that the discoverer of Göbekli Tepe wrote in his book called just Göbekli Tepe in 2012, that the Anunnaki are the memory of the prime movers behind the creation of Göbekli Tepe, and that their
That's
home.
it.
Yeah, go on.
Well, we're going to go on a quest in a few minutes. The quest for our super civilization, as Hugh Newman describes this book in his foreword. But before we go on that quest, we're going to take a brief break. We're talking to Andrew Collins. His latest phenomenal, and I don't use that word lightly here, book is called I'm still struggling, folks, from the smoke I've inhaled. It is called Karahan Tepe, and it is about basically the remains of a super civilization that predated Sumeria and was centered in Turkey. Andrew, one of the things that strikes me, and I want to work into this, one of the things that strikes me is the fact that there is a gigantic human statue there. And human forms are so rare in Ice Age, for example, in the caves, the cave paintings of the Ice Age. You never see just the sketchiest human forms. Now, there is this tall, extraordinary being. Are we talking about the Anunnaki here? What, tell us about that, and let's sort of build into the story from there.
So I was going to show you something. The oldest statue in the world is actually that, which is what's known as Urfa Man. This was found at Şanlıurfa, which is just a few miles away from Göbekli Tepe, and that dates to about 9,000 BC. And I mean, it's quite an incredible
Oh,
statue. I
it's
mean,
absolutely
it's got these
extraordinary.
black obsidian eyes, obviously very human anthropomorphic features, and I mean, this is 6.5 feet tall. It formed part of a stone enclosure from the same age as Göbekli Tepe and the site we're talking about, Karahan Tepe. But last year, well, no, 2023 now, an enclosure was discovered on the top of Karahan Tepe, which is a limestone hill in the very remote Tek Tek Mountains, where since 2019, archaeologists have been uncovering literally dozens of enclosures of one size or another. And we'll talk about some of the others in a second. But in 2023, they uncovered a huge, massive stone enclosure like those at Göbekli Tepe on the very top of the hill itself. It's got T-shaped pillars, it's got benches, it's got an altar that faces towards the north northeast. They found this incredible vulture statue standing actually by the altar itself, facing into the enclosure. And just to the right of the vulture, as you as it were stand in the interior of this enclosure, they found this incredible statue, and it's human. In fact, it's even more human than Urfa Man. Let's see if I can show you a picture of it. And it's 7.5 feet tall. I mean, that's how big it is. But what's so important about that fact is that it's sitting down. So, in other words, if it stood up, it would actually be, possibly as much as 9 feet tall. Well, there's only a bad picture of it in here, but let me just show you here. I mean, the book unfortunately was put together. I don't know if you can see it
Yes,
there.
we can see.
And
We'll have an image on the
okay,
show, so you don't need to really
okay,
hold it up.
okay. Well, I mean, it's got a every facial detail. It's got a haircut that looks is like a mullet, which looks like something out of the 1980s. Although I know that they're coming back into fashion, particularly among soccer players.
I don't think either of
He's
us have to
got
worry about haircuts.
we don't. I mean, and this guy's holding his phallus basically, and I mean, it's an incredibly large statue. In every way. And you have to ask yourself, what does this represent? And I mean, even the archaeologists are quite happy to accept that it probably relates to some kind of divine ancestor, or a celebrated ancestor. But why is he so tall? Is it possible that the ancestors of these communities of what the archaeologists refer to today as Taş Tepeler, which means stony hills, the stone, because they use that in the construction of their buildings, their monumental architecture. But hills referring to the occupational mounds that were created as all of these structures were made, and then you would create like a layer cake of human activity as you gradually filled one structure up and built another one on top, and another one on top, another one on top. they create these tepes, that's what they're called. And this is the name that the archaeologists want us to, to accept as the name of this civilization. But who is this great ancestor and where do they come from? Well, I think that it does actually represent an Anunnaki, because I think that they were the memory of the prime movers, the shamanic elite behind the creation of this civilization, which, as you say, my colleague Hugh Newman, who's written the foreword, refers to as a super a civilization, because they were just so extraordinary on every level with their technology, their innovation, their cosmology, the alignments of their sights towards the celestial bodies. I mean, it's something that you would not really expect to exist until perhaps the last couple of thousand years.
But
I
it's
mean, when I've.
far more advanced.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Go on. I mean.
I think at this point I would like to get into the serpent symbolism
Yeah.
because it's so incredibly important in North America. Of course, there's the Serpent Mound. In the Pyramid of Unas on the left wall, as you go in, is a description of the body, and the spine is described as a serpent surrounded by seven smaller serpents, the beginning of what become the idea of the chakras. The serp and of course, in the Bible, the serpent leaves the body, it ends up in a tree, and turns out to be a bad guy.
That's right.
But this serpent is so important to our understanding of ourselves. And the snake symbolism in Karahan Tepe, in my opinion, still stands as an inner potential inner journey for every human being who will take a look at it. So will you've taken quite a good look
Yeah,
at
of
it.
course. Of
So
course.
let's go.
Yeah. I
Tell
mean,
us about it.
the first ever T-shaped pillar that was found at Karahantepe showed a snake curling up its front narrow edge. And I mean, this was the thing that took me there for the first time in 2004. I mean, that was the first time I visited Karahantepe. But since that time, since the excavations, they've found lots and lots of snakes, crawling up the side of pillars. There's a huge, great human head that is in what we call the pillar shrine, which has been dug out of the bedrock itself, and to leave these 10 pillars sticking out of the bedrock. I mean, there's that, but coming out of the west wall in the direction of where the hill is this giant human head, probably about three times the size of a normal human head, and it's on the end of a very long serpentine neck. I mean, it looks like something out of Beetlejuice, if you've seen that film, that the human-headed snake that crawls out of the wall there. It's a very, very similar thing, and so that's a snake. You've got snakes incised into benches. You've got huge curves cut into the bedrock that are clearly serpentine in nature. So, what is this snake stuff all about? Well, firstly, this pillar shrine, if you look at it from above, and I was able to show this and demonstrate it in the book, it is in itself the head of a snake. It is the exact shape of a snake, and particularly a local snake to that region that's native and indigenous to the Tek-Tek Mountains, which is the Anatolian meadow viper, which we now know was being used by this community almost certainly in rituals because its bones have been found there. And so you've got this pillar shrine cut down into the bedrock. It's got these 10 pillars sticking up. You've got this serpentine head coming out of the wall. So what's all that about? Well, the only way in the past that you'd have been able to get into this shrine was through this tiny little rectangular porthole stone that's cut into a thin wall of rock left standing at the southern edge of it. So you'd have had to crawl through that and get inside the head of this snake. And once you're inside there, I mean, what do you do? I mean, why would you go into the mouth of a snake? I mean, it's possible even that the pillars sticking out from the ground actually represent the fangs of the actual snake. Well, I think the answer is that these people wanted to become at one with the snake. They wanted to not just connect with it in some kind of psychic fashion, probably during altered states of consciousness, but I think that they also wanted it to possess them and to allow it to speak through them to deliver information, knowledge, wisdom, in the same way that you get at places like Delphi in Greece, which is a cult of Apollo. And beneath the temple of Apollo, according to myth and legend, was this, this secret chamber that had a fissure in the ground, and a priestess known as the Pythia or the Oracle would sit on this tripod-shaped seat, and the fumes coming up would intoxicate her, and this would allow Apollo to possess her, and she would then speak as Apollo, and the pronouncements that she would make could decide the fate of kingdoms, of kings, and even the gods themselves. But what's so interesting is that the fumes were coming from a dead serpent that had been killed by Apollo himself, according to the story. But the other important thing is that Apollo was not possessing her in the form of a human being. He was possessing her in the form of a snake, because that's the manner that Apollo would appear in this oracular fashion. And you can see this from Greek vases that recalled imagery of the Oracle of Delphi. So I think that something similar was going on at Karahantepe, but it was much rawer. I think that they were going much deeper. It was far more shamanic in nature. I mean, even to this day, in certain countries around the world, there are religious cults where people get possessed by snakes and end up rolling around the ground, and hissing and speaking as the snake. I described them in the book. And I think that something similar was going on at Karahantepe 11,000 years ago. But then the question becomes, what is this snake? Is it some kind of god, a goddess, a spirit, what we call a snake genius? In other words, some kind of spirit in the form of a snake. And that is obviously what I wanted to try and establish, which we'll come on to, obviously.
Well, let's take another break at this point, and we'll be right back. I wonder if the snake relates in some way to the celestial alignments, in particular in relation to the Milky Way and the galactic bulge that you discuss in the book. I'm not sure, but let's go on to those alignments, and I'd like to see where you kind of take this, because it's possible to see the Milky Way is not a river in the sky like the Egyptians did, but perhaps it's a snake, or maybe this was the younger Dryas, and they were seeing extraordinary auroras in the sky because of all of the explosions that were taking place on the sun because of all the debris coming into the solar system. So anyway, let's go with that.
Okay. Well, firstly, arguably, what is the earliest celestial alignments can be found at Karahantepe. My colleague Hugh Newman and his partner J.J. Ainsworth were lucky enough to identify one in connection with this Pillars Shrine, which we've been talking about. They were there at midwinter, and a shaft of light came in through this porthole window that I've described and hits this giant head just a few minutes after sunrise. Now, we think it had a roof, and we also think the sun would have been slightly lower in the past, which would have made it even more spectacular than it was when they first saw it in December 2021. I've been back there at the time of midwinter and witnessed it a couple of times myself, and it is an incredible phenomena. And it only hits the head, so it brings alive that head. But there is another enclosure next to it, which we call the pit shrine, because it's got this huge, great swimming pool-like pit in the center of it, and almost like a diving board at the side of it. And indeed, theories do suggest it may have contained water in the past. But I noticed that it was pointing towards the northwest, and I surmised very early on, although I needed this confirmed by working with my engineer friend Rodney Hale, that it was probably aligned towards sunset at the time of the summer solstice. And indeed, we worked out the position of the sun and obviously the exact orientation of this enclosure, and it's perfectly aligned to the sunset at the time of midsummer. Now, this is an incredible thing, and it was the thing that actually prompted Hugh and JJ to go there just a few months later to see if anything happened 6 months later at the time of the winter solstice. And I'm so glad, all of this played out in the way that it did. But what I did was to wait for a couple of hours and see what was in the sky once the sky went dark in 9000 BC. In other words, I used a sky program to click forward in time just a couple of hours to see what would happen. And I beheld a wonderful sight, because at the exact position that the sun had just gone down out of sight, the Milky Way stretched vertically upwards. And right in the middle of the Milky Way at that point is what's known as the Dark Rift. The Dark Rift reaches up from the area of Sagittarius and Scorpius, which would have been just setting at that point, towards Cygnus, the celestial bird, the Northern Cross, which is universally seen as an entrance into the sky world. I've talked about this in many of my books in connection with the
Yes.
alignments at Göbekli Tepe, as you know.
And I
But
just want to say, folks, I will put a link to one of the great all-time interviews on Dreamland. It's with Andrew about Cygnus. Go ahead.
yeah, but let's not forget Cygnus for the moment, because what's more important is what was going on at the horizon where the Milky Way is standing, because you've got what's known as the galactic bulge. The galactic bulge is a bright area of the Milky Way that represents the center of our own Milky Way galaxy. Now, obviously, the ancients in theory wouldn't have been aware of that, but they would certainly have been aware of the galactic bulge, because in the past it would have seemed like a light bulb in the sky. It's that shape. And the interesting thing is, with the dark rift going through it, it looks like the head of a creature. And this is very often interpreted as a snake, in other words, a serpent, which immediately allowed me to identify what this cosmic serpent is, which I had come to believe is what these people at Korahantepe were focusing their attentions on. And it is, of course, as you quite rightly have said there, the Milky Way itself. The Milky Way is seen in many cultures as a snake. You find it in Mesopotamian myth, in Akkadian myth, for instance. You find it in Hindu tradition. It's there in North America. It's there in Central America. It's there in South America. It's there in Greek mythology. It's there in amongst the indigenous religion known as the Yazidi, in the eastern part of Turkey, although those they're not no longer there, they're dispersed into other areas of the Near East. I mean, it's a fairly universal idea that the Milky Way was a great snake in the sky, and that its movements regulated the celestial bodies, that those of the sun and the moon. And beyond this is that quite clearly this was seen as some kind of cosmic entity that was a representation of an intelligence in the sky. And these people, I think, were interested primarily in its head, because the head for them, or the skull, was the place of the soul. Their symbol of the soul was either an abstract skull or even just a circle. This is accepted, excuse me, and is represented in many different places. It's found at Göbekli Tepe. It's found on many graves from this period, that have been identified in southeastern Turkey from the Mesolithic and Neolithic period. So, in other words, they're going to be interested in the head because that's where the seat of the soul is. So that's where it would communicate with you. Right by it is the stars of Scorpius, how can I describe it? Like a tongue coming out of the snake itself. And of course, that would be an active symbol of the spirit of this cosmic serpent. And although we know the Scorpius mostly as a scorpion, in many cultures it was actually seen as a snake. And indeed, in North America, you mentioned Serpent Mound. Serpent Mound has been interpreted as a representation of the constellation of Scorpius in its form as a snake, because we know that Serpent Mound is aligned towards sunset at the time of the summer solstice, exactly like the pit shrine at Karahan. And at the exact time that this alignment takes place with the wind, the wind, sorry, the summer solstice at Serpent Mound, Scorpius is basically coming into position due south, and the alignments of all of the coils, the head, everything seem to suggest that there's a relationship between the setting of that sun and the rising, and the appearance and the reaching of the zenith of Scorpion. This is something that was advanced by an archaeo astronomer, academic by the name of William Romaine, and I've discussed this whole subject with him, and his quotes on the subject are in the book. But it's pretty universal. I mean, if you look into Norse myth, for instance, there is quite a famous image that was done in the 19th century of the cosmic schema of the Norse people, and it shows the world tree called Yggdrasil that has its upper branches in the sky world. Its central area, i.e. at the base of it, in the Middle Earth or the Middle World, and its roots in what's known as the lower world, or obviously the underworld, if you want to call it that. And around the tree is a huge ocean. Now, this isn't simply a material ocean. This is what's known as the cosmic ocean, and coiled around within this cosmic ocean is a huge serpent. I mean, it's known as the Midgard serpent. And this was a part of the beliefs of the Norse people. So this is a very good representation of this cosmic scheme that was pretty universal around the world. And we find it, for instance, at Göbekli Tepe on what's known as Pillar 43, otherwise known as the Vulture Stone. On this, you have this great vulture, which I've identified as the constellation of Cygnus in its form as the vulture, which is exactly what it was in the Near East and remains so to this day in Armenian sky lore. Armenia is next to Turkey, and in the past actually covered the whole area that included Göbekli Tepe. And above this are three so-called man bags. I'm sure people have talked about these before, and
Yes, I think they're a universal symbol around the world.
they are, but I'm afraid to say that the ones at Göbekli Tepe are not man bags. I mean, firstly, the handles are completely offset to one side. And how many handbags have you seen where the handle is offset to one side? I mean, it would go all wonky if you tried to put anything in it. No, I don't think that they're handbags at all. What they
I
are
don't think any of them are
representations.
handbags.
Yeah. No, I know. I mean, this is the term that people are using. I mean, obviously, they're different things for different functions, but these are the three worlds. These are represent the sky world, the middle world, and the lower world. And around them is the is like all these chevrons representing the cosmic ocean itself. In other words, this whole this all of the carved art on this particular stone is almost like an information board telling the shaman what to expect when they go out of the body and enter into an altered state and travel to the sky world, travel to the lower world, and travel even beyond that. What will they see? What will they expect? The vulture itself is not simply Cygnus. It also represents what's known as the psychopomp. The psychopomp is what carries the soul from this world to the next and back again. And the reason why the vulture is so important is because human bodies were left out on high places, and the vultures were allowed to come down to pick clean the flesh from human bodies, and then the bones would be collected up and put in a secondary burial. This still takes place on the Tibetan plateau to this day. I mean, just put in to Google search Tibet sky burial, and some very gruesome images will come up because it still takes place now. Monks, Buddhist monks are still putting out, their fellow monks on their point of death, on high places for this same thing. It's a tradition which has been going on probably for tens of thousands of years. So the vulture became a symbol of the transmigration of the soul from one world to the next and also back again. I mean, in other parts of the world, that bird is replaced by other more familiar birds, like in Europe, in Siberia. It's generally the swan or the goose that takes that role. In America, it's generally the turkey vulture or the eagle that takes that role, and et cetera around the world. It's whatever birds come to symbolize, the psychopomp that calls, that allows the body, the soul to go from one world to the next, either accompanying it or guiding it or guarding it on that journey. So that's what Pillar 43 is all about. So we're gradually building up here, and there's much more, of course, the cosmology and the cosmogony of the Tashtepala culture, this first post-Ice Age civilization. But what's important is that because a lot of this imagery is universal and is found not just on the Eurasian continent, but also in North America. I mean, much of the sky lore, for instance, to do with certain constellations that we know in Europe and also obviously in Asia, matches that of North American Native American indigenous peoples. It's the same. I mean, various constellations like the Pleiades is always seven daughters or seven sisters. That's pretty universal. The Ursa Major is almost always to do with a great bear. Cygnus is always generally a bird in the sky, et cetera, et cetera. So these ideas have to be earlier than Göbekli Tepe and Karahan Tepe. In other words, these ideas were inherited by the Tashtepala culture, this super civilization. And of course, the question then becomes, where did it come from originally?
Well, that is an incredible question because, you spoke of the Seven Sisters. As long ago as ancient, as 600 BC in Greece, it was commented that why do we call them the Seven Sisters? Because we can only see six stars. Only one culture in the world calls them the Six Sisters, and that's Japan, the Subarus. They were visible seven stars, probably no later than about 60,000 years ago. We have been calling them that since what it feels like the before the beginning of man. Maybe the Neanderthals called them the Seven Sisters because they saw seven stars. So I'm going to throw this question right back in your lap. Where did they come from? Where did the Karahan Tepe people and the Göbekli Tepe people come from?
Well, I mean, we have to be fair here. I don't think it was one single human group that created it, but we'll come on to the most important at the end. But you've got indigenous peoples there, peoples that would have lived in southeastern Turkey at the time of the arrival of any other human group. They would probably have been living up in the mountains. They're known as the Zazian peoples. And you would probably have had people coming in from Western Turkey, the Aegean area, where we know that there were seafaring cultures because they were going over to Cyprus and creating permanent communities over there. So this wasn't just the odd, sea journey occasionally. This was constant journeys from the mainland to Cyprus as early as 11,000 BC. So they must have been incredibly advanced. So, those peoples are probably making their way into southeastern Turkey as well. Plus, you've got people coming up from the south, from the Levant, countries today like Israel, the Palestinian territories, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, all the way down into Egypt. I mean, we know that there were settlements in Egypt at a place called Helwan within sight of the Great Pyramid that were using exactly the same tools as those of Göbekli Tepe. In other words, there was clearly a cross-cultural connection between these different peoples and perhaps even direct communication. In other words, peoples may well have been travelling from Anatolia all the way to Egypt, certainly at the time of Göbekli Tepe. But there is an X factor, I think, as well. And that X factor is the prime movers who I think kick-started it all. And all of the evidence seems to suggest that they came from as far east as Siberia and Mongolia, having passed beneath, to the south of the Ural Mountains that divide Europe and Asia, and come along the steppe, the Russian or Eurasian steppe, either through Iran or over the top of the Caspian Sea and down across the Caucasus Mountains to enter into Anatolia, something that they probably did during this time that you've already alluded to, that the Younger Dryas. The Younger Dryas was a 1200-year mini ice age, but today there is good evidence to suggest that it was triggered by some kind of cataclysm caused by a fragmented comet entering into the atmosphere and breaking up into probably hundreds, if not thousands, of pieces that exploded on their descent down towards the Earth, creating huge wildfires across the Northern Hemisphere, blotting out the sun for an extended period of time and plunging the world back into a ice age. We'd already come out of the previous ice age a couple of thousand years earlier, but now we're in the new one that only lasts for about 1,200 years. But it's at the end of that that Taj Tepala is created, places like Göbekli Tepe. But even before this time, you've got settlements appearing just to the east of the area of Taj Tepala on the Tigris, close to the huge inland sea of Lake Van, which date back to 10,500 BC. And these people are dealing with, excuse me, exotic materials like obsidian, which is a volcanic glass, which is so sharp that it's even used today in surgeries. And they were trading. These people were trading in this, and they were gradually moving eastwards. And I think that they were the prime movers. They knew how to enter into communities. They knew that they could influence possibly even control communities in a way which I think related to these cataclysms, because at this time people were still in a state of what Barbara Han Clow, the great visionary writer, referred to as catastrophobia, the state of the fear of a further catastrophe. In other words, every time that a comet came into the sky, they'd fear that the end of the world would come. And what I think happened was that these prime movers, this shamanic elite, who we remember under the name the Anunnaki, came in and said, look, you know, we can sort out your problems. We can make sure that no further cataclysms take place, but you must listen to us and do what we say. And this will involve you building these stone enclosures with these T-shaped pillars and putting certain carvings on them that will reflect this cosmology that we're bringing to you. And people did it. And the reason that they created these stone enclosures was for easy access into the sky world to deal with the supernatural creatures, the tricksters that were seen to be responsible for cataclysms. When I say tricksters, think in terms of Coyote in North America, who is the trickster there. Sometimes he's good, sometimes he's bad. They had similar tricksters in Europe and in Southwest Asia, and that was usually either the fox or the wolf. And there is fox imagery and comet imagery together at Göbekli Tepe, particularly on Pillar 18. And the fox tail is a universal symbol of a comet. And in Mayan tradition, whenever a comet would appear into the sky, and this was witnessed by early Christian missionaries in the 16th century, the priests would adorn themselves with the tails of animals, particularly that of the fox, because this was a symbol associated with the comet, and they would do their rituals, they would make their sacrifices and appease these supernatural creatures to stop them bringing about further cataclysms. This was still going on in the 16th century. You know, so we can imagine that something similar was taking place at sites like Göbekli Tepe and Karahan Tepe as early as 9600 BC, immediately after the end of the Younger Dryas. So again, this feeds into what these people were doing. But then the next step is, well, who were these people? Where did they come from? And I think that, as you pointed out earlier, some of these sky myths are going to date back certainly to 40,000 years ago, perhaps even, as you suggested, 60,000 years ago. And the people that we know were existing in that area, Siberia and Mongolia at this time, were the Denisovans. The Denisovans are distant cousins of ours and also the Neanderthals, who, from all of the evidence that we have, were of giant size, very big, and big heads and elongated heads. But also, they were incredibly sophisticated in technology and in innovation. They created beautiful jewelry. Just look up the Denisovan bracelet. They created the first bone needles with eyes to create tailored clothing. They may have even ridden horses. They also were the first people to make notches onto bone, representations of animals that clearly represented the movement of the sun and the moon, you know, key numbers. The other thing that we know about the Denisovans is that they passed on genes to us, modern humans, that relate to autism. And what we know comes with autism is savant-like qualities. In other words,
telepathy.
Absolutely, definitely telepathy. Telepathy not just between human beings, but between humans and animals.
Yes.
Autistic people today, you know, are able to literally communicate with animals. How they're doing it and on what level this takes place, we can only but speculate. But in other words, the relationship between the Denisovans and, of course, their descendants who would have also had these genes would have been the ultimate form of shamanism, the ultimate form of animism. And this is what creates this cosmology, which is then brought into Southwest Asia and ends up in Anatolia, kickstarting Taj Tepala and the super civilization.
There's no one else in the world who can do what you just did. That is awesome. My hat is off to you. You are one of the best deliverers of knowledge on the planet. If there's anyone around here who has Denisovan genes, it's you. That was very impressive. We have come to the top of the hour, folks, and until I get my act back together and I'm back in my office and I'm not suffering from lung problems, we're going to keep the show for 1 hour because, however, for subscribers in the third half, in the next half hour, I'm going to do a meditation which involves orbs, such as the ones Andrew was talking about a little earlier. They are living beings and they do relate to us. And you will see this happening during this meditation. So don't miss it. Andrew Collins, Karahan Tepe, one of the many great books on the subject of the distant past. Don't worry about holding it up. We'll show it. We'll show a I know you're always told, don't forget to hold the book up, but they'll be seeing an image of the book right now. In any case, one of the greats. Thank you, Andrew, for being with us. And what is your next journey? Where are you taking this extraordinary adventure called The Life of Andrew Collins next?
Well, interestingly enough, it's much closer to home because there have been so many new discoveries to do with Stonehenge recently, that my next book will begin there. And I mean, just the way that it will start is the fact that the most exotic stone there, known as the Altar Stone, which has long been known to have come from somewhere else, has been identified as having come from northeastern Scotland, possibly even the Orkney Islands. Now, we've long known that the blue stones came from West Wales, and that's about 175 miles away. But now you've got this huge 16 feet long, 6 ton stone made of a type of sandstone that would have looked almost like a doorway of stars in the past. Having come from northeastern Scotland, what the hell is going on? Why is this there? Plus, we also know that there was a second altar stone. So, the quest becomes what happened to that? But the bigger question is, what is the relationship between these altar stones that would have stood side by side in exactly the same manner as those of Göbekli Tepe?
Oh my
In other
God.
words, You know, in other
Wow.
words, what is the relationship between Stonehenge and Göbekli Tepe? That's where I'm going next. That's what the next book will answer. And of course, for this, we have to show what was going on at Stonehenge as early as 8 to 9,000 BC, and there was a lot going on. And I think that the same culture that was the behind the creation of Göbekli Tepe also ends up in Britain.
I can only say, wow. I'm glad I asked that question, folks. I have a feeling Andrew will be back with us very soon. What a story. I'm going to be in England in the summer, and I'm definitely going to try to intersect and see where you're taking this extraordinary story. Andrew Collins, thank you so much for being with us on Dreamland.
Thank you. And obviously, if you're interested in anything we've talked about, andrewcollins.com.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by unknowncountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.